When I hear people ridiculing vaccines, I think of the playground at Gordon Public School when I was a young kid. The boys who disappeared. The boys who came back in calipers after a bout of polio, limping around in pain. How they scared us. And the panic, the huge panic, during the royal tour of 1954 that she, our young queen, might catch the disease. And I remember the day my terror of polio disappeared. The day we lined up at school to be given a shot of Dr. Jonas Salk's vaccine. Here's to vaccines. The last known polio transmission in Australia was in 1972. Australia was declared free of the curse in 2000. But a strange silence has fallen over the polio years. A silence that intrigues Newcastle historian of medicine, Professor Catherine Colborn. She knows it from her own family. Her mother had a bout of polio in 1950, but has never to this day really talked about it. Catherine is researching the Great Silence, digging through mountains of archival material to understand not just her mother's experience, but how Australia grappled with and then shut up about this plague. Catherine joins me from Newcastle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David. What a moving introduction.
Why was polio seen as dirty?
Well, I think you alluded there to shame, and many diseases actually have shame attached to them. But because polio was something that was seen to be associated with people who perhaps lived in poorer neighbourhoods, potentially the way children particularly could be infected was through dirty, unwashed hands, really meant that people saw this disease with some incredible fear, and it was very stigmatised. One of the reasons why I got interested in this was I used to teach a course in 20th century world history, and there's some really powerful footage from a series called the People's Century, which is a co-production of BBC and PBC in the US. And they had this amazing footage of public health warnings in the UK, which depicted polio as a kind of stalking shadow. It stayed with me, and particularly because I started to associate that footage with what my mother's experience must have been.
So it was known that polio was transmitted by snot and shit. It was seen as somehow the sufferer's fault.
Yes, that's right. And I think particularly also because, you know, we're talking about periods of history, the 1930s, where there were very significant outbreaks in Australia, in Victoria, Tasmania, and then the 1950s, where there's that lingering memory of those episodes. And, you know, some of the scientific explanations for disease are still emerging, and some of the concepts of disease transmission are still being articulated.
But there's another thing, isn't there? That diseases for which there are no cure are somehow shameful as well.
I agree. And I think one of the other sort of interesting backdrops that we have now is the COVID pandemic, and the fact that while COVID was raging and there was no vaccine, you know, for quite some time around the world, and there was a race to find the way to control the outbreaks and so on, there was a lot of misinformation, there was a lot of confusion about transmission and, you know, how to avoid contracting COVID. And we saw, you know, even just a few short years ago, that the panic that created. And I think if you start thinking about polio in that light, absolutely, that's the kind of mood that took hold.
Polio was always around. I mean, it had been first identified in the 18th century, hadn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It has a much longer disease history, but it's in the, you know, flare-ups and outbreaks through the 20th century that it really starts to become a problem.
I remember at the time there was lots of press about all the good work being done, and that somehow dealing with polio was a sort of a community effort, and, you know, the best possible face was being put on it. But we saw those photographs again and again of people lying in iron lungs. What was the iron lung? What happened to iron lungs?
Well, it's interesting, actually. There was an Australian invention that replaced the big old heavy iron lungs, and it was invented in South Australia, and it was known as the Both iron lung. And I've been interested in this just most recently because it was much easier to use and more portable, and it opened up and was hinged around the edges so people could get in and out more easily than the old ones where people would have to be slid in. And so Australian innovation in polio can be seen in through this iron lung, but also through some of the people involved in vaccination research. And the iron lung has an interesting kind of presence because every time people talk about polio to me, they think about the iron lung and they mention the iron lung.
Yes.
And but not everybody, of course, had an experience of being confined in an iron lung. Those people who were could spend decades inside
really?
This breathing apparatus, mechanical respirators, essentially, just to keep them alive.
But people lived out their lives in iron lungs?
Yes, I mean, my understanding is that people could get in and out, but for long periods of the day, every day, they had to be on the respirator to essentially have enough air to breathe. It's an interesting kind of image, isn't it? And I think that's why it captivates people so much.
Yes, they're all smiling for the cameras, and all you can see is the head sticking out of this long iron tube and being brave for the press.
I'm really glad you said that because that's what has really struck me about all the images that I've seen so far in my research and indeed the kind of public-facing public health messages and narratives all picturing these smiling people, either using crutches or wearing calipers, children and young adults. And it has really struck me how it's very much a depiction of getting on with it, pushing through.
Yes.
And not giving in to this idea of disability or this idea of physical failure.
Stiff upper lip, living with what you've got.
Exactly. And indeed, when my mum, she was 7 years old and she recovered, her story is actually quite a positive one, in terms of when we think about all the people infected by polio. But she returned to school and she tried to return to her running. She'd been a very good runner as a young child. My aunt, her sister, tells me that she was never as fast again. But this is what people did, They got back, yeah.
And let's not mock the stiff upper lip.
Mm.
Catherine... But first, what exactly is polio? What does it attack in the body? Why was it, is it so dangerous?
So it's an enteric disease, and that means it can be transmitted orally and through the means of faeces or, as you say, other kinds of infected matter. So people could contract it through infected water, for example, and it attacks the nervous system, the central nervous system. So it affects people's motor system, their movements, their physical abilities to actually walk, breathe, as we've heard with the artificial respirators. It can also leave long-lasting effects through life in terms of cognitive impacts and so on, which is what many of our older people in Australia who had polio are now living with.
I'm talking to Professor Catherine Colburn, historian of medicine at the University of Newcastle, about the strange silence that surrounds the polio years in Australia. Catherine, how did your mother know she had polio?
Well, that part of the story is not entirely clear to me, and one of the reasons why I'm doing this research is to find out what people's common experiences were. And the dominant narrative coming through all the oral histories and recollections that I've been finding is that people first had ordinary flu-type symptoms, but they worsened, they didn't get better. And when they called doctors would either, the children, if we're talking about children, would be taken for a lumbar puncture test or diagnosed in some other fashion. Not everybody had that puncture test. And indeed, paralysis could set in quite quickly for some people. And so being very unwell with a kind of flu-like illness was really the main symptom.
She later on wrote a sort of fiction of this and put it down to snake bite. How did that... What was she trying to convey and what was she trying to hide?
Well, this is my reading of it. And it's a story, actually, it's about spider bite. So she writes this story about a woman and her husband, and the woman suddenly falls down in the garden and feels very strange and can't get up. And they put it down in the story, the the couple. They put it down to the fact that she's probably been bitten by a white-tailed spider in the garden because she's been gardening. And the amusing thing for me, well, it's not amusing, I suppose, it's something I've reflected on, is that two or three things here. I knew from my father that my mother had had episodes later in life of sudden paralysis and falling. And her mobility hadn't been very good for various reasons over many years. And he knew that there was a connection to polio, but she didn't ever want to investigate that particularly or join any post-polio groups or anything like that. Secondly, my mother didn't really garden.
Dead giveaway.
So when I read the story about the couple, you know, navigating this this suddenness of a paralysis episode in the garden, I think, well, that's Mum describing her polio episodes, to be honest. I can really feel it coming through the story. And there's a, yeah, the tone of the story is really around, working together to solve this problem, which I think probably was also part of their narrative together.
And you were never able to, or you've never been able, your mother is still with us, been able to quiz her about this. Is it one of those things that you just know you can't talk about?
Well, over the course of her life, it's something she didn't really want to talk about. I know I tried about 15 years ago to raise it with her because I'd met another older woman in my neighbourhood who'd joined the post-polio associations and had, you know, really benefited from some of that socialising with people who'd experienced polio. And that's a very powerful movement in Australia. It provides lots of support to people. And indeed, they funded the oral history collection at the National Library of Australia some time ago now. So I thought that could be a useful thing for her, but she wasn't interested. And I know that she was kind of particularly not very interested in seeing doctors during her lifetime either. She's somebody who has rejected those kinds of forms of help and special kind of care.
It sounds to me so like the reluctance of returned soldiers to talk about the war.
Mm. Well, I find that very interesting because time and time again when I'm reading the transcripts or listening to the oral history interviews, this theme recurs. It's a silence in the family. It's a fear of what the neighbours thought and people staying away from the household where there was known to be polio. There's a sense that you didn't talk about it later, you got on with it, you returned to school or work and you just went about your life. And it's this stoicism which I find both impressive in our context because it's not something that I think we're much more prone now to talk openly about illness and really in some ways let it define us in some respects. But in the case of polio survivors, there's a real sense of just wanting not to have to live in that mode, but to get on with ordinary life.
When I read your account of the way in which the community responded to having a polio family in the street, it reminds me so much again of the early responses to AIDS.
Mm.
It's this notion that you might catch it by just looking at someone.
And I think this is my career-long, lifelong interest in health and medicine and disease because it's so interconnected with the way we socialise, how we interact with social groups and with each other intimately or on a larger scale. And certain forms of disease, particularly infectious disease that are somewhat stigmatised, really bring out these kinds of worries and behaviours. And, you know, tend to shape the mental responses, the psychic responses that people have.
Now, I know that, like me, you were a great fan of Trove.
Mm.
The machine, the National Library's machine for searching newspapers, documents, way back to the very beginning. What have you been able to find by searching through Trove about this public response to polio outbreaks?
Well, similar to COVID days, we see figures reported on a regular basis in the major newspapers, counts of how many infections and reports of how many deaths in different localities. And so there's a sort of headlining of polio, particularly in the major outbreaks in 1950-51 is one that stands out to me because I am focusing mostly on the 1950s through to the 1970s. But this was also true of the 1930s. So there's plenty of newspaper stories and also obviously about once vaccines become available in the mid-1950s. there's a lot of attention to how we might, how people could obtain the vaccine, where they could go, its safety, its efficacy, and, you know, related public health kind of messaging. So that's certainly, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of reporting around these epidemics.
Was there even criticism of vaccines back then? Were people saying, don't go anywhere near them, they'll kill you, they'll turn you blue?
Yes, well, there was. And there were episodes in the United States when the Salk vaccine that you mentioned in your introduction, when that was first introduced, there were some mishaps with some small populations of children being affected. And so there was some caution, therefore, in New Zealand and Australia about what to do. But once additional testing of the vaccine, it was actually manufactured in Australia through the Commonwealth Serum Laboratories. And so their history is really, really important here. They supplied the vaccine to New Zealand as well. We supplied the vaccine to New Zealand. So our manufacturing and testing of the vaccine batches was critical to its success. So there were people who were opposed to the vaccine, who wrote letters to the government and who proselytised in other ways through different sorts of little pamphlets and pieces where they scorned the medical understanding of the virus and the vaccine. So, yeah, they were very similar to the sorts of things we've seen recently.
They didn't have the internet to spread their message, did they?
No, little booklets that end up in the archive, which are quite interesting. But, you know, in those days, and I have come across some material in the National Archives where Prime Minister Menzies just dismisses it, dismisses the naysayers about the vaccine and just pushes on and gets on with it, which is a sort of very powerful message.
Yeah. And he pushed on with the Royal Tour in 1954. They went to Western Australia despite the fear.
Mm.
But there were to be no more large gatherings of school children for her to wander through.
That's right. Mm.
Now, look, not everybody was silent about their experience of having polio. Indeed, there's a famous Australian book about it.
Yes, that's right. Alan Marshall's much beloved book, I Can Jump Puddles, which refers to his 1930s experience or late 1920s, early 1930s experience as a child with polio. And it's been a much loved text in schools for primary school children for many years. I remember reading it when I was younger. And his papers are in the National Library of Australia as well. So there's certainly been really good writing in Australia about Alan Marshall, about polio. There's a great book by Kerry Hiley called Dancing in My Dreams, which is about confronting the spectre of polio, published in 2015. So there are other well-known people who've told these stories. I think where my research differs is that I'm really trying to do two things. One of them is to surface those ordinary people's memories that are held in existing oral history collections across our country in different repositories and libraries, and, you know, make sure people know about those, but also trying to find out what those, I guess, everyday understandings of polio and how people now remember it. So there's another strand to that remembering that could tell us new things that we haven't heard before about, you know, the nature of polio as a disease.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Catherine Colburn about the strange silence that hovers over polio in Australia. Catherine, polio isn't done, is it? It comes back.
That's right. Most recently in the Middle East, 2 or 3 years ago with the Gaza conflict, traces of polio were discovered and there were rapid attempts to get in there and vaccinate populations in the Gaza Strip, which did happen. Same thing in other conflict zones around the world. There's been reports of polio tested in water in New York City, for example. So it's certainly something that can return. And, you know, again, thinking about these wonderful oral history interviews that were conducted a few years ago now, over 10 years ago, a number of the people who are interviewed say that their express purpose for getting involved in the project and agreeing to be interviewed is that they don't want the same thing to happen. And they all pretty much, I mean, the ones that mentioned vaccines in detail, all express this wish that that's the legacy of their interview, that people understand the importance of vaccines. So yes.
But we do have to take vaccines forever?
Well, the polio, the Salk vaccine was the first one that was put out in 1955-56 across Australia. That was an injectable vaccine that used a deactivated virus. And so that meant three vaccine shots. And that was more difficult to administer across different populations, particularly remote populations in Australia. And that protected people. And, you know, I think there is a sense now that if you're travelling, I've had travel warnings for going to countries overseas, for example, asking me to check my polio vaccination status. The Sabin vaccine that was released in 1967 is an oral vaccine of the live virus, which meant that it was actually much easier to, because it was taken as a little syrup on either dotted on a sugar cube.
I remember that.
Yeah, or a little drink. That was much easier to take into remote areas and in countries of the world with populations that were dispersed and remote as well, in the third world, for example. So I'm very interested in vaccination history. And in fact, one of the key areas, my research is at an early stage, but one of the really key things that I want to get out of this is understanding our vaccination history in Australia, because polio vaccines have implications for other types of vaccines, population education and public health messaging, the understanding of what, you know, what has gone into vaccine research. All of these themes are really important and critical, and I'm really hoping to undertake a lot more research about that so that I can actually share that knowledge.
Now, to wind back to the time of the you looking at the oral histories, they must also talk about the treatments they were given. And what do you get from reading about those treatments, about whether they were just torture or were they effective torture? I mean, did it take time to work out how you dealt with the human body that had been given a bout of polio?
By the 1950s, there was much more acceptance of the Sister Kenny methods, which were around massaging and moving limbs that had been in splints and immobilised.
Remind us about her.
So Sister Kenny was an Australian nurse who came up with some what had been regarded in earlier periods in the pre-1950s outbreaks. She was seen as quite a controversial figure. She was recommending that people move their limbs and have hot compresses and massage and things that had been seen as a bit radical later took hold. There's been a lot of writing about Elizabeth Kenny, and you know, she's also left various archival collections for people to research. And there's an interesting Australian medical historian, Naomi Rogers, who's written quite a lot about Elizabeth Kenny. So I'm not necessarily looking in depth at her work, but certainly by the 1950s, her methods become much more accepted. So some of the people who have been interviewed talk quite a lot about this massaging of the limbs, very, very painful, the hot compresses, the way they were sometimes, I don't know that this was a Kenny method, but some people were suspended so that they were turned around so they could breathe more easily if they were suspended on their fronts. So lots of physical kind of therapies like this.
Instead of immobilising patients, get them moving.
That's exactly right, yes. Mm.
Your mother's mobility recovered almost completely. As you were saying, she's not as fast. She was not as fast a runner as she had been before. But what else did she live with from her bout of polio?
She never drove a car, so she's in aged care now, and she's not able to really communicate very well. So that's one of the reasons why in the recent past I haven't been able to talk with her. But even, you know, even before that, she was reluctant. But she didn't ever drive. There's a sense that her legs were not necessarily working both together at the same time very effectively, and she lost confidence physically. So there's a sense of physical timidity, I think, that she lived with, and a nervousness, and perhaps even also a little bit of agoraphobia, in terms of, you know, the way she lived her life in a kind of quite private way. And she's had great circles of friends, she's travelled, she's had experiences, but I certainly think her personality was affected by these kinds of experiences of isolation.
All to be reflected in your work.
That's right, yes.
Now, look, I've been asked to give a warning that you're not looking for fresh oral histories on polio
right.
experiences. For polio survivors who want to put down in writing what they went through, where should they go?
Well, thank you so much. That's a fantastic segue because while I am looking at these existing oral history collections, and I think we need to honour those, they're so rich across Australia, we need to share those rather than add, you know, inexorably to them. But in my work, I'm going to be having a digital facing humanities, digital humanities research site where people can learn about polio, they can see what research has been done, and there will be an opportunity for contributing and exchanging stories there in a format where people can upload their story. And I just also want to say that Polio Australia also has a website where people have uploaded stories. So it's not designed to compete with that, but rather to help me curate those kinds of stories where people want to come forward. And, you know, since I've published my article in The Conversation and also had other radio contact locally here, I actually have had many people reach out to me and wanted me to tell their stories. Yeah, so...
How big is the pool of survivors in Australia?
So a few years ago, it was estimated at about 40,000, and that would be people in their 70s and 80s. I think it's probably a little less now, but that's a significant number of people who may still be living with post-polio syndrome and the after effects of that experience as well.
Catherine, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
I've been speaking to Catherine Colburn, Professor of History at the University of Newcastle, and her new project is called My Mother's Polio, Australian Experiences of Poliomyelitis, 1950s to 1960s. This is Late Night Live.